Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll deal with a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and speak with the Pulitzer Prize winning investigative journalist Seema Hirsch, who broke the My Lai massacre story and recently the Abu Ghraib story. He's been the first to report on U.S. military plans to attack Iran in the New Yorker. His latest piece in the New Yorker, The Redirection. We'll be talking to him about this extraordinary revelation, the extent to which there's a vast Iran-Contra type operation running out of the vice president's office involving billions of dollars of Saudi money, financing the very al-Qaeda type people that are attacking us around the world on the theory that the enemy of my enemy is the friend, the enemy, of course, the new enemy being the Iranians and the Shiites. And we'll be the White House spokesperson, Dana Perino, in response to Seema Hirsch's latest article, said that Seema Hirsch has a wanton disregard for the truth. So we'll be looking into how a Chinese appetizer has anything to do with plans to bomb Iran. And then we'll speak with Andrew Coburn, journalist and author. He's written extensively about the Middle East for the New York Review of Books, and he's also a regular contributing author to the National Geographic and Counterpunch. His new book is Rumsfeld, His Rise, Fall, and Catastrophic Legacy. Let's now go to the subject of plans to attack Iran. I'm speaking with the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Seema Hirsch, who's been covering the Middle East, particularly Iran and Iraq, in his series in the New Yorker, The Annals of National Security, the latest being The Redirection. Is the administration's new policy benefiting our enemies in the war on terrorism? And I guess to begin with, Seema Hirsch, the fact that we're talking about a redirection might indicate that the White House has been successful in changing the subject from Iraq to something else.
Oh, absolutely. I think the White House is very pleased. In fact, I've been told by people inside that among the things that they think they've dealt with very effectively is Baker-Hamilton, the Baker-Hamilton report. They think they've nullified that and changed the policy. Yes, you know, 20 years ago when we were doing policy, there was a famous line about mid-course correction. This is almost the same thing. But the redirection is certainly, you know, let's forget about Iraq. That's you know, whatever, whether they're willing to say it or not, it's a dead end. Instead, we're gonna rescue our presidency. Presumably, the president, this is in his interest, by focusing on Iran and focusing on stopping the movement, the nascent movement of the Shia.
Well, the fact that the Baker-Hamilton group went public, apparently they met privately with the president, he showed absolutely disdain and disinterest in it, and it almost forced them to go public. And even then, when he did his press conference with Baker and Hamilton, he was churlish. And it indicates, I think, that this president really doesn't really like advice from anybody and probably doesn't care what anybody says.
Well, who knows? I mean, you know, everybody has an opinion. I have no idea. I can tell you some things about Cheney, perhaps, because I can have some insight into what he thinks. But this president is really more than just opaque. He's off the screen for all of us. Mm-hmm. We don't know what happens between him and Cheney. We don't know any of the real discussions. Those are all. I think they have a weekly luncheon. We know his public comments, and I tend to take George Bush very seriously about what he says publicly, and he's been very bellicose about Iran, and I would deal with that seriously. I wouldn't necessarily think he's just saying it for, you know, to try and bluff Iran out. Right. I think he seriously wants to do something. That doesn't mean he will.
What about Cheney, though, as much as what you know about him? He's just taken a trip that in many ways could be laying the groundwork for what they're planning to doing, at least what you've...
It's so funny. I had a military guy, actually a special forces guy. You know, some of these military guys, having served in the Army myself, black humor is really a big thing. I had a military guy, I think the day before yesterday, say to me, "Oh yeah, Cheney's tour of hate," he said. That was a funny line, going to China and getting him mad. Going to Australia, right in the middle of the White House, explaining to everybody and there are no plans for attacking Iran, and he then says, "Of course, all options are on the table." He's quite a piece of work, Cheney. I think I don't know what the president believes, but I think Cheney's view, and I'm saying this with some I've heard this, from people who have first-hand access, which, you know, that's about all you can do in this with these guys. They're very tough to get to. But Cheney really believes that the issue is Iran now, and a nuclear-armed Iran is a strategic threat. And I think Cheney sees Hezbollah, the Shiite group led by Sheikh Nasan Hasrallah, the group that defeated Israel last summer and fighting for power now, political power in Lebanon. Cheney sees Hezbollah, the one-time terrorist group, as the brown shirts, literally, you know, from the old Third Reich days. And if Iran gets a bomb, they'll give it to Hezbollah, and Hezbollah has sleeper cells all over the world, including in America, and they will deliver it to their cells, and New York and Washington will be blown up. Therefore, what Cheney believes he's doing, and I presume the president too, is not protecting the Middle East with all of this, or Western Europe, but us. This is all about protecting America. And we will soon know, it might be 20, 30 years, but we'll eventually know that they were right, and we were all wrong.
Well, but it's not just Cheney, is it? He runs an alternative National Security Council, which is largely staffed by a small core group of neoconservative ideologues who, and apparently he's also spending a lot of time with Elliot Abrams, who's you've profiled in your article, Seymour Hersh, the redirection as being, from the old Iran-Contra days. And what I connected, the dots that I connected in your article was that this, the what happened with Iran-Contra might well be happening in spades here in the shadows, since we don't have adequate oversight. The CIA's been cut out of the loop, and we have an active vice president, and we have a group of ideologues whose track record doesn't seem to bother them. And they are, in fact, this is amateur land unbridled. And when you look back at Iran-Contra, it was a picayune deal. Something like $10 million was transferred to the Contras. What I'm reading between the lines in your article is that we could be talking about, billions, tens of billions. There's so much black money sloshing around in Iraq, it's hard to know the amounts.
Well, that's one, it's more than between the lines. I wouldn't say that there was any competition between the NSC and in terms of policy and Cheney. I think they're on the same page, the same people, the same principles, neoconservative. I think the White House is pretty much Cheney's group. I don't think Cheney's lost any power. And it was more than between the lines. I was saying, and quote people to the effect, that there's a lot of unwashed money around. By that I mean billions, as you say. There was, I think, one government accounting office report about the oil money that there was a hearing on it the other day before in the House, before Congressman Waxman's committee of California. And something like $8 or $9 billion is unaccounted for, and we had people like Mr. Bremer of the Coalition Provisional Authority, CPA, remember years back, sort of saying, well, I don't know what happened to it. We needed the cash, and we distributed it, but we didn't account for it. $8-9 billion of Iraqi oil money. There was also a lot of money that was found in Saddam's personal possession that wasn't turned over to the Treasury. And also, I'm told that when we took over various ministries, we found a great deal of cash, $1 billion or so in those. So this leads up to huge piles. And plus, what I was saying is that Prince Bandar, the former Saudi ambassador to Washington, who's got a very strong relationship with Cheney et al., has also been putting up money. And the whole purpose of this money and using this money is you don't have to go to Congress. You don't have to go get a finding from the president. You don't have to go and have some Democrat like Nancy Pelosi or somebody like that, who's a ranking member of the House, tell you can't do something. And so they choose not to. They choose to make everything they're doing military in nature. Therefore, under the way they read the law, if it's a military operation, the president as commander-in-chief has an inherent right to do what he wants. He doesn't have to run it by Congress. It's all part of preparing the battlefield.
Well, what we know so far, though, is that through the Saudis and through the Jordanians, there is active training and equipping of Sunni counterweights with Fatah in the Palestinian territories, through Saad Hariri in the Lebanon, and through the Muslim Brotherhood in Syria.
That's certainly a fair statement. The question is, how closely can you tie it to a direct American money? you know, as somebody, I quote somebody as saying, you know, we just throw the money in there. There's no, you know, nobody signs a receipt. And some of the money, you know, you, it's like the old Tom Lehrer line about Werner von Braun, aim for the moon, you know, the rocket scientists at World War II rocket science for the Germans, you know, with the V-1 bomb. He aimed for the moon, but often hit London. So they throw the money up, and nobody knows quite where it lands. And some obviously lands in the pockets of internal security people in the Lebanese government, which is Sunni and pro-American, in a political struggle against the Shiite Hezbollah. And that government, they funnel that money through cutouts themselves into at least three jihadist groups inside Lebanon. These are groups that I think I wrote that 3 years ago my government would have arrested on site and brought into Guantanamo. Instead, we're looking the other way as they get rearmed. Now, I cannot prove that an American dollar went there or that any specific American knew about it. Just like I cannot, you know, we could not prove that when Abu Ghraib took place and these kids were putting their thumbs up and thumbs down, that anybody in the White House knew exactly what they were doing. But generically and generally, there's a lot of stuff that's happening that it can be laid to the feet of the Americans.
And you, last Christmas, met with Sheikh Nasrallah, the head of Hezbollah, who's on the run and presumably a target in the crosshairs of the Israelis if they could find him. But he apparently told you that he fears Sunni assassins financed by the Jordanian and Saudi intelligence services.
Well, actually, what happened is I went to see him, and I've seen him three or four times in the past, usually to talk about Iraq. This time we were going to talk about Lebanon because he's involved in a political movement. He has set up his political party, the Party of God, which is controlled by Hezbollah, has been in coalition with a Christian party headed by a former chief of staff and former prime minister, Aoun, and Michel Aoun, a Christian, who got 76% of the vote, of the Christian vote. So it's a powerful combine. They're trying to improve, rewrite the legislation that that controls the distribution of power in the parliament and the cabinet. Right now, under the various agreements that they have, it's called a confessional system in Lebanon. The Shiites, who make perhaps are close to 50% of the population now, there's been no actual census since 1943. The Shiites get 20% of the parliament, and Nasrallah wants to change that. And so does Aoun. And so we have a increasing tension. So this time I went to talk to him about that, all these things. And the security was, I was in and out of basements with being swept down, and eventually got to his apartment. And I knew the Israelis had made a death threat against him. When I asked about it, he didn't say this. One of his aides did, said that that the real problem was Jordanian intelligence operatives and also the jihadists, the Sunni jihadists, the Salafi and Wahhabi, very fanatical right-wing, in the sense that zealots, in the sense that anybody who's not a Salafi, a Sunni Salafi, is an infidel and can be disposed of.
Mujahideen, I believe, is the...
I beg your pardon?
Mujahideen is what Bob Baer told me they call them.
Oh, really?
The apostates, the fallen.
Oh, yes, those who are on the other side.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's funny, it's a similar word in India and in Urdu for those Indians who Pakistani leaders who were born in India.
Right.
They also have a pejorative word for that. In any case, so it's just a very complicated, you know, we want to support these jihadist groups because in case we get into a shootout with Hezbollah, our Lebanese allies and the Sunni allies of the government that runs the country, the Sinjar government, if we get into a shootout, we want some tough guys on our side too.
But it falls under the category of the enemy of my enemy is my friend, and it's very similar to what we went through in Afghanistan, where the same Salafists, the same Wahhabis, who are fanatical and who really, at the end of the day, hate us more than just about anybody, even the Shia, who they look down on. And I, from your article, Seymour Hersh, I got the impression that, again, we were playing with fire and the chances of blowback were evident.
Well, for sure, but I mean, I look, the chances of a serious escalation in Lebanon a confrontation between Hezbollah and the Sunnis of the government that we are very close to, the Sunni government, are great. And if that happens, you're going to see sectarian warfare, Sunni versus Shia. That hasn't happened in Lebanon before, just as you're seeing sectarian warfare, Sunni versus Shia, in Iraq. We've brought a lot of really good things to the Middle East with our invasions, haven't we?
Well, you know, I recently spoke with Martin Van Creewel at Hebrew University, who's an Israeli strategist, and he was very critical of the Bush invasion, saying it was the worst strategic blunder since Emperor Augustus sent his legions into Germany in 9 AD. Nevertheless, he didn't seem to be worried about the Sunni being ethnically cleansed by the Shia in Iraq and then ending up in Jordan and destabilizing Jordan and therefore eventually becoming a threat to Israel. He actually gave credence to this sort of neoconservative Likudnik vision where the Sunni and the Shia, to his mind, could be fighting a 30 years war. And I said, well, how's that going to impact Israel? He said, you know, no difference. We can handle terrorism. So do you foresee that we've ignited a spark here for some other Machiavellian reason?
Well, I think it's actually more, you know, since these guys there's not much evidence that they think very far beyond what they're immediately doing. I think this is all more in the realm, today, I think it's more in the realm of unintended consequences, certainly for the president. There may be people in the president's staff, you mentioned Elliot Abrams, who have different ideas and are much more sophisticated and knowledgeable about the Middle East. But I don't know on what basis the president made his decisions. I don't know if he's fully aware of what he's getting into. You know, we're not only expanding the covert or clandestine war using people, retired agents and others being paid by money that isn't appropriated by Congress. We're not only doing that in Lebanon, we're doing the same in Syria. We're doing much more aggressive stuff in Iran, much more aggressive stuff, cross-border stuff, more intense planning. None of this means that it's going to happen. We're going to bomb Syria, but, you know, I'll give you another theory. We could do something in Lebanon before we go to Syria, but who knows?
Well, Syria is somebody described it as a rotten fruit about to fall. And what would the point of getting rid of the minority Alawites? Surely you would end up with some version of the Muslim Brotherhood.
Well, one of the things we're working with is Bonders putting up funds for a dissident former vice president named Haddam, who has joined forces with the Muslim Brotherhood and is running operations, or at least thinking about or attempting to, claims to, inside Syria. There's been some problems of bombings, et cetera, over the last few years in Syria. And one of the more acute jihadist groups that ended up in Lebanon was pushed out of Syria. And then once they got to Lebanon, they were supported by the Signora, the government of Lebanon, the pro-American government. We're all in the dark here. We're trying to figure out, you know, underwater, feeling the tail of the elephant.
Well, I guess the fact that we're discussing the possibility of the United States attacking Iran, and other apparently world leaders have brought it up to the president, and many senior military people have gone on television, including on the BBC recently, urging the British people to urge Tony Blair to urge Bush in turn not to go into Iran. So the fact that there's enough alarm out there that we would do something that many people think would be crazy and counterproductive, I think is an indictment of our foreign policy. Surely.
That's a fair statement.
so just in closing, to get a sense of what may be in store vis-a-vis Iran, of course, there's going to be a meeting hosted by the Iraqi government, although, you know, that's something of a joke when we refer to it as a government. It wouldn't exist but for its protection within the green zone. But nevertheless, they're hosting a bunch of the neighbors, and, of course, the Saudis and the Iranian president just met. Obviously, the Iranians are concerned and quite nervous, and I believe that you have information that they've been digging extra holes to hide in.
It's so interesting. I'm sure the Iranians are concerned. We'd like to think they're sitting there terrified, waiting for the bombs to come, but they may not be. They may be very, you know, resigned to it. And, you know, I think they think it's coming, and they have been doing a lot of proactive work, digging a command structure, so their leadership can survive. But I just think any bombing we do will solidify the religious, the Islamic government of Iran, solidify them as the most important government in the Middle East, and increase tensions in the long run. I just don't see anything we can do to mollify this except to seriously begin to think of withdrawing unilaterally.
Well, what about the notion that as Bob Baer joked recently on my program, that the exit strategy from Iraq is through Tehran, and even though he believes that we'll drive the people back into the hands of the mullahs and condemn them for 20, 30 years of misrule, there may be an element of petulance on our part to sort of cover the defeat in Iraq by punishing the Iranians.
Well, you are certainly right about that. It's depressing, isn't it? I wish I could give you a better answer.
All right. So that's your reading on it too. That if it happens, it will be sort of it doesn't matter that it's not rational.
We're talking. I mean, I had a very, very dispiriting lunch with somebody who knows a lot more about it than I do. Who thinks the chances of warfare are very high. I just don't know, but I think the chances of something what they call kinetic bombs being kinetic force, it's just sort of overwhelming. And I just am not sure that the men making the decisions in this White House have any real idea of the real issues at stake. You mentioned Ahmadinejad coming to Saudi Arabia. That's been in the news. I don't think there's much to that. And I'm right with you. I don't think there's much to Condi's visit. The coming negotiations, that's not going to be, don't forget last year with great fanfare. Condoleezza Rice, it was announced that she was going to participate in talks over the Iranian nuclear program, with Iranians claiming that they're just working for peaceful purposes, and America saying, and the Israelis, they're trying to master the nuclear weapon cycle, fuel weapon cycle. And so in any case, she came, and the issue was, oh my God, it's wonderful, we're going to sit down with the Iranians and in sort of multilateral talks. But it turned out we had one requirement before she sat down. We were willing to sit down and discuss the future work of the Iranians on nuclear issues, as long as Iran, before we sat down, stopped all of its work. So the American demand was that the thing to be negotiated had to end before we started the negotiations, unilaterally. I mean, it's a non-starter. I just don't know if we're going to get much better out of this one now.
Well, just to go back to your article, Seemahosh, the redirection, what is clear from your article, and obviously it's we're speculating on whether or not we'll pull the trigger against Iran, the long and the short of it is that it looks as if this Iran-Contra model is alive and well, and the same players are involved, yet this time around there's billions as opposed to millions of sloshing around in these black areas. It seems that we desperately need oversight, and I know that the purpose of these off-the-shelf independent operations are to bypass the CIA and bypass congressional oversight. So, and we just learned in the last week that the intelligence oversight completely missed the exaggeration of the North Korean uranium program, which was the pretext for cutting off our deal that we had on the plutonium program. And now, of course, they've gone and built extra nukes. So it's this long-winded way of saying, where's the oversight? When is Rockefeller and company going to get a backbone and start subpoenaing Elliot Abrams to tell them what the hell these guys are up to?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know why you're worried about it. It's just doing is, it's a good old American tradition that the Bush people enjoy very much. We're just outsourcing intelligence. In this case, we're outsourcing clandestine operations by American agents. We're outsourcing it to the control of the Saudis. That doesn't bother me. It seems like a perfectly rational thing to do, and I can't imagine why Congress would be upset. It is so far off the wall as
right.
I just sit here and I say, wow.
Right. Well, it's kind of, if you think that Halliburton's got a blank check in terms of the military side of things, imagine the deals that have been made on the intelligence side.
Okay, I'll let you do that.
Okay.
I have no idea.
Thanks a lot, Si.
No problem, my friend. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. Just speaking then with Seymour Hersh, the Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist who broke the My Lai massacre story in the Vietnam War and more recently the Abu Ghraib story. He's been the first, among the first to report on the United States military plans to attack Iran in, as a regular contributor to The New Yorker, the latest article being The Redirection. I'm now speaking with Andrew Coburn, who's a journalist and author who's written extensively about the Middle East for the New York Review of Books, and he's also a regular contributor author to the National Geographic and Counterpunch. His latest book is Rumsfeld, His Rise, Fall, and Catastrophic Legacy. And just, of course, recently, in the last week or so, Andrew Coburn, the Walter Reed story has broken, and again, you get the feeling that even though Henry Waxman is talking about the privatization of outpatient care being ideologically driven, it does seem to smack of cronyism and corruption. Former Halliburton official apparently was given the contract. They fired 600 experienced federal workers and replaced them with 50 people who basically had no training and were minimum wage types. And apparently that's is this the legacy of Rumsfeld, that if you're politically connected, you can form a private company and get hang up a shingle, have no experience, and then get billions of dollars sent your way?
Well, more or less, yes. I mean, in a way, it's not his only legacy or even his biggest one, but it's certainly part of it. He didn't start it, but he, you know, accelerated it to a huge degree. I mean, the most, you know, visible part is not just healthcare, but privatizing the Iraq war. You know, they have 100,000 contractors in Iraq, basically, you know, mercenaries, who are actually subject to no laws, not even the sort of vestigial controls that that are on the actual military. And that was very much part of a Rumsfeld endeavor.
And in your new book, you've start out with him before he came into power, and it's interesting that that Clinton wasn't watching the ball here, that Rumsfeld found himself or somehow got into the idea, into these exercises that were conducted starting before the Soviet collapse on the continuity of government exercise. In other words, when there's a nuclear war, everybody goes off to the bunker and continues on. Of course, it turns out that the entire U.S. plans were given to the Soviets by the FBI turncoat Hansen, but that's another story. And the long and the short it was that it turned out that these COG, continuity of government exercises, where Rumsfeld got to play president, which apparently is an ambition he's harbored for some time, he was able to sort of network, as it were, right under Clinton's nose.
Well, that's right. I mean, the Clinton people never really understood what was going on in the whole national security field. They were sort of too terrified to really intervene and take a close look. And what was happening here was that Rumsfeld, as you said, you know, he'd dreamed for years. He's always thought he was more fitted than anyone else in these United States to be president. And he had a stab at, you know, becoming president. I mean, he eventually, you know, he ran for the 1988 election and collapsed almost immediately because people just didn't like him very much. But he sort of, instead of that, he went off and played president in these rather spooky war games where they'd practice nuclear war, you know, practice playing at nuclear war with, I call them the most expensive video games ever. At one point, they were spending $1 billion a year on them. And what was happening in the 90s was the official running these exercises in charge was actually a Republican. And he thought it'd be quite a good way, if the Republicans got back in to the White House, you know, he would be a good way for him. So he started recruiting people like Rumsfeld. I mean, there was Rumsfeld already there, but also other people who, particularly neoconservatives, who'd go off and, you know, practice blowing up the world and would, you know, have bonding sessions deep under some mountain in West Virginia or wherever.
Well, you touched on the neoconservatives. There's also in your book, there's this extraordinary exchange that takes place in August of 2004 when President The current President Bush takes a break from campaigning to visit his folks in Kennebunkport, and George Bush Sr., 41, hands him a note from his former National Security Advisor, Brant Scowcroft, who had advised against this misadventure in Iraq. And Bush refused to read the letter. I think he crumpled it up. And then after his got over his petulance, he then asked his father, apparently aware that people were becoming critical of the Iraq war and the architects of it, and apparently he turned to his father and says, what's a neocon?
Amazing that he didn't...
excuse me.
Amazing. Yeah, he said, Dad, what's a neocon? And the father said, well, do you want names or a description? So Bush Jr. says, description. And the father says, I'll give it to you in one word, Israel, which is very instructive on a number of levels. Mm. You know, what the father thought about the neocons, the son's amazing ignorance about the clique that has hijacked his foreign policy, and a few other things besides. Yeah, so that's, one of the benefits of doing this book, one of the pleasures was doing it at a time when the sort of Bush administration was in decline, and they're not declining perhaps fast enough. That the people from the inside are prepared to reveal what's been going on.
Well, but give us an explanation, in which your book does, but for the benefit of the audience here. I've never understood why it is that Cheney and Rumsfeld, and let's face it, they're joined at the hip, and most people, I don't think, realize that, in fact, Cheney is Rumsfeld's protege in mm-hmm. political terms. Why did they become the enablers of the neocons? I mean, what is the connection? If you say it's all about Israel, what is Cheney and Rumsfeld's connection? Neither of them are Jewish, as far as I know, and have any great affection for Israel. So how do you explain that?
Well, actually, you see, the point is it's not all about Israel. I mean, it partly is, of course, because most neocons are Israel supporters. But I trace the very beginning of the moment when the neocons, or neoconservatives as they're called, sort of really first came to power, or first made their influence felt. And it was really, as I explained in the book, it was in the mid-1970s, and there was a very potent figure, particularly a chap called Paul Nitzer, who was like really the sort of architect of the Cold War, or certainly one of the driving forces of the Cold War.
Yeah, I knew Paul.
Ah, okay. Well, you know that he... He never let anyone underestimate the Soviet threat.
Mm-hmm. I think Jimmy Carter was so stupid not to hire him, and it's the old adage of LBJ is it's better to have somebody inside the tent urinating out than outside the tent urinating in. And
well, exactly.
And he didn't give him a job, and then he formed a committee on the present danger.
Before then. Right. But in the Ford administration, they were preparing to form the Committee on the Present Danger. Nitzer had had this insight. I know this from people very close to him, including people in his family. He'd had this insight, which was Israel supporters, although supportive of Israel and supportive of people who supported Israel and their politicians here, otherwise they were very dovish on national security. So, and they weren't much help in the defense budget. I mean, they had been anti-Vietnam War and so on and so forth. He represented the defense lobby and was always looking for ways to increase spending and increase, heighten the U.S. military aggressive posture. So he actually, what he did when he fought what the Committee on the Present Danger and the neoconservative movement that he fostered was really all about was uniting the Israel lobby with the defense lobby. And something very potent emerged out of that. And that's how Rumsfeld and Cheney came on board. Mm-hmm. And it was a fusion of interests. And, with rather drastic consequences for our country.
So is that to say, though, and I've always thought that this was the real case, that, we make the mistake of dignifying the neocons and calling them defense intellectuals, the Richard Perls, the Wolfowitzes. And mm-hmm. to my mind, they've always been shills for the military-industrial complex. Remember, Perl started out working for Scoop Jackson, the senator from Boeing. Mm-hmm. It just seems that if you and they're, people like Gaffney and they're still at it. Their job seems to be to, either gin up the Russians or gin up the terrorists or gin up whoever. Now it's Iran, of course.
Right.
Just to keep the money flowing for the military-industrial complex.
Absolutely right. And they, you know, they show, unfortunately, so no signs of slackening in their appointed task. I mean, Richard Pearl, I talk about a lot in the book, and his influence on Rumsfeld. I mean, he was, you know, I found very interesting that Rumsfeld, you know, is a pretty arrogant chap and doesn't, you know, really defer to anyone intellectually. I mean, he always considers himself the cleverest person in the room, which he most certainly is not usually. But one person he is prepared to defer to, or has been in the past, is Richard Pearl. And, you know, I found it surprising to discover what a close connection there has been. Well, really, ever since the days, as you mentioned, when Richard Pearl worked for the late Senator Scoop Jackson in undermining detente in the mid-70s. And that's when his sort of alliance and relationship with Rumsfeld was formed. And it's, you know, it's endured ever since, to the point where Rumsfeld wanted Pearl to come work in a high position in the Pentagon, but Pearl was making so much money out of Conrad Black's enterprises. He was sort of in cahoots with Conrad Black, who is about to go on jail or go on trial in multiple fraud charges. He was a Canadian publisher. So Pearl was really cleaning up at that point, so he refused. He said, "No, I won't come and work, take a job in the Pentagon, but here's my trusty sidekick, Douglas Feith." So Doug Feith, who, you know, immortalized by General Tommy Franks as the bleep, bleep, stupidest person on the face of this earth, came and took the job instead. So, you know, it's very interesting the line you're pursuing, that this marriage, I always regarded the relationship between Rumsfeld and the neoconservatives as a love affair of convenience, really.
Hmm. But of course, the person that they had to get out of the way in order for this marriage to succeed, the interloper or the cuckold, if you will, was Henry Kissinger.
Well, yes, that's right. I mean, that's where it all started. There was Kissinger pursuing his own, usually vile ends, vile pursuits. But he was, I mean, you know, it had suited his position under Nixon to pursue this rapprochement with the Soviets so they could sort of, you know, the idea was they'd sort of divide up the world between them and therefore have a sort of, you know, basically, I wouldn't say people, I mean, when even I call it arms control, but it was really arms regulation. The idea was to regulate the arms race with the SALT agreements. And, of course, the military-industrial complex didn't really like that. They hated the idea of any regulation or control.
Yeah, because deterrence was the ultimate racket, because there was never enough deterrence.
That's right. You always need more to deter. Yeah, so they, so the Kissinger, so that really you had this, you know, this coalition of, coalition of the present danger, but coalition between Rumsfeld, the young Rumsfeld as he then was, and Pearl and the neoconservatives and Paul Nitzer and everyone, against what they regarded as the wicked Kissinger. And in the end, they won. Really, they won.
Well, let's go back to the thrust of your book, Andrew Coburn. The book, Rumsfeld: His Rise, Fall, and Catastrophic Legacy. I mean, it's clear that that famous exchange that took place in Kuwait on television, where the Tennessee National Guardsman asked Rumsfeld about up-armoring the vehicles because they were starting to take casualties from the IEDs, and he was saying, you know, we have to go to the scrap yards and try and weld stuff together. And Rumsfeld made the famously disdainful remark about, you go to war with the army you have, not the army you wish you had.
Right.
And it's sort of, I'm just trying to get a handle on, I guess it's not surprising in a way that both Rumsfeld and Cheney and Bush, all of whom are sort of collectively delusional about what's happening in Iraq, would be so behind reality, the reality curve, because Rumsfeld initially referred to the looting as untidiness. He referred to the insurgency as dead-enders.
Yeah.
Recently, Cheney on CNN recently said they may have had fantastic successes in Iraq. Bush said, bring it on, et cetera, et cetera. So how do you, you know, were they just inherently incapable of understanding what was happening in that place, because they are so arrogant that they believed so strongly in what they were doing that it sort of became a de facto reality, and reality itself was an inconvenience.
I think that's a large part of it. Yes, that's exactly right. They, they managed. You know, when you're in those positions, you have whole squadrons, armies of people whose sole function it is to keep reality at bay. You know that. Bush, you know, as we know, doesn't even read the newspapers. Probably why he didn't know what a neocon was. Had people, you know, whose sole job it was to bring him good news. So, and Rumsfeld similarly, you know, Rumsfeld did not like to be told bad news. Walter Reed, just to go back to that for 1 second, Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz, we shouldn't forget Paul Wolfowitz, always liked to let it be known about, you know, they'd casually mention how often they go to Walter Reed to bond with the wounded, and you know how much shows how human they are and how they care about the poor wounded chaps. And none of them ever noticed that the ceilings are falling down and the cockroaches running around. So they're very good in that position. They're very good at insulating themselves from reality. And because they'd gone ahead and done this, you know, this embarked on this war in defiance of informed advice. You know, the military said, really, this isn't a good idea. And if you are going to do it, go and, you know, the military were pretty timid, but they did indicate that, you know, that this was they were really going about it the wrong way, and the State Department was saying you're going about it the wrong way, and if you must do it. So they defied reality in a very proactive way before they went in. So when other people's gloomy predictions started to come true, they had, being sort of, you know, nasty, arrogant people themselves, they had more of an impulse to pretend it wasn't happening.
Well, I think one of the things that's extraordinary about them, though, and particularly Rumsfeld, if you go back to the Afghan war and, you know, the response to 9/11, and Bush's keep hammering away saying we've got to strike back, and the Pentagon basically don't have any war plans to speak of for Afghanistan, and the CIA fills the breach and they actually conduct a very successful operation. Rumsfeld, meanwhile, is just petulant and ticked off and jealous that that George Tenet's getting all the FaceTime with the president, and they're cut out of the loop, and he basically sabotages the Afghan war and lets Bin Laden go free, and then diverts resources to this war on Iraq. And he made the most amazing statement, which to me reveals the total antiquated Cold War thinking of this man. He made the famous remark that the trouble with Afghanistan is that they're not enough good targets, whereas in Iraq there are good targets.
Well, that's right. You see, that is part of his mindset. What he thought, and insofar as he had an ideology, it was this, which was that the U.S. to go on being top nation and to have everyone sort of scared of you, you have to really give someone a really good whacking. He was influenced, and there was a terrible old fellow who was his sort of mentor in a lot of things. There was a former French diplomat called François de Rose, who he met in Brussels in 1974, and who was always telling him this, that the U.S. has to assert its strength. You know, your friends in Europe are dismayed. You're not asserting your strength. So what he meant by that ludicrous remark was, you know, we can't really make enough of an impact by just bombing a bunch of mud huts in Afghanistan. We have to take on something, you know, destroy something more formidable, more visible, like Iraq. So it was really, it's actually chilling as a sort of point of view, but it's also inane.
But that's ultimately going to be his legacy, isn't it? That he was the man who basically bankrupted the U.S. Treasury and the misappropriation of defense money now is so outrageous, because they never got away from the Cold War programs, which he never canceled, and they have no idea how to handle the new subnational and transnational threats. and they're trying to spend money on everything, and then the war is costing them so much that even the replacement cost for the military equipment that's been chewed up is into the 50 billions.
Yeah.
And so we have this completely bankrupt, and we are spending more money than the rest of the world combined on defense, and yet we are unable to deter our enemies and win wars. We've already lost one war in Iraq. We're in the process of losing a second in Afghanistan, and if we're stupid enough to attack Iran, we'll probably lose a third big time. So this is, and yet, from your book, Andrew Coburn, here's a man who's more interested in fighting the war against Colin Powell than...
Well, that's right. I mean, you know, he Rumsfeld was that sort of person. He didn't, I'll make the point, he was an appallingly bad, even his enemies used to say, well, you know, he's a no-nonsense CEO, even though, you know, his policies are very bad, but he was sort of hopeless, you know, as a CEO of the Pentagon. I mean, he managed very badly. There was no follow-through. He couldn't, you know, he was intimidating and bullying, at the same time weak. You know, he scared them, he intimidated the military and scared them on things they cared a bit about, I mean, like the war, but gave way on things they really cared much more about, which was defending their, you know, their sacred programs, you know, the Air Force's F-22 fighter, the Army's future combat systems, which is, you know, $170 billion and rising. You know, there are faults on all sides here, but I think, you know, what you have to bear in mind always when discussing this sort of thing is to not fall into the trap of thinking that the U.S. defense system has much to do with defense. You know, you say, as you just said, you know, we spend all this money on defense, and yet we can't deter people, you know, from attacking as terrorists and so forth. Well, the point of the defense system is to spend money, and Rumsfeld was pretty good at that.
Mm-hmm.
But the point was it... you know,
so in other words, if we lose wars, it doesn't matter. They still make money.
Well, right. But the whole thing, now the whole budgetary thing is why we're going broke. The whole budgetary thing is completely out of control. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, Rumsfeld gave up, because he was so sort of ineffective in this way, he gave up even sort of controlling the service budgets. He told the Army to go out and make their own budget last year, which is, you know, that's his job. His actual the job definition mm-hmm. of Secretary of Defense is to police up the services, which he sort of failed to do.
But Andrew Coburn, in your book, Rumsfeld, His Rise, Fall, and Catastrophic Legacy, you reveal for the first time that, again, I was saying that, you know, the real war that Rumsfeld was fighting was inside the Beltway bureaucratic war, which Kissinger once described him as the most lethal bureaucratic infighter, and that's some compliment coming from Kissinger. So here he is for the first 6 years or so of the Bush administration, secretly meeting at the White House with Cheney and Bush without Powell and Rice knowing about it.
That's right. You know, it's an incredible, it's the ultimate bureaucratic prize is to meet alone, I mean, really alone with the president. Normally when they talk about a one-on-one meeting with the president, there are six people present, you know, aides and, you know, other people. But he was really meeting one. He'd sneak over to the White House. And that was, you know, it was his MO, as you say, this basic battle. For example, he fought, you know, with every vicious bureaucratic technique at his disposal to get control of post-war Iraq, you know, the mandate for post-war Iraq, away from the State Department, where it belonged, and under the Defense Department, you know, under him. And finally, the president, you know, signed National Security Decision Directive No. 24, and that gave the Pentagon responsibility for post-war Iraq. But once he'd got it, he did nothing. He absolutely forgot about it. He'd won the battle. He'd won the important war. He'd dished Powell again. So he was happy. I mean, you couldn't give a hoot about actually doing the job. And, you know, the results we can see.
But it's extraordinary, though, the lack of priority, and that at the end of the day, you know, people think that history is done by, you know, great armies and great actions, but at the end of the day, it's really about personalities, it seems.
That's right. You're absolutely right, and it's personalities operating for petty motives. I mean, the pettiness with which these people behaved is quite remarkable. I mean, like, between Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz, okay, you may not like them, and as you can probably gather, I don't, but there they were. They were the two most senior officials in the Defense Department. Rumsfeld was sort of resented Wolfowitz a bit, And just one way he had of putting Wolfowitz in his place was when he, Rumsfeld, went off for an important meeting at the White House with the President and the Secretary of State and Secretary of the Treasury. He'd come back and Wolfowitz would say, well, what happened? And Rumsfeld would refuse to tell him. There was no reason not to tell him, and he was the deputy Secretary of Defense. He had to know what the policy was, but Rumsfeld just wouldn't tell him. So the Deputy Secretary of Defense had to run around town asking, trying to find out what the policy was. Hmm. I mean, a pathetic way to run a government, and yet that's the way these people are.
Well, just in closing, Andrew Coburn, what do you think any of them understand what they've done? I mean, how much the catastrophe that they've wrought in geopolitics, and here they are about to perhaps even dig the hole deeper by attacking Iran. But so clearly they're not, at least Bush and Cheney haven't learned anything. But what about Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, those people? I mean, they've got to see that they got taken in by their buddy Chalabi, the whole thing. I mean, they're laughably incompetent when you think about it.
Wolfowitz still thinks that there are weapons of mass destruction hidden in Iraq. I happen to know. Rumsfeld, when he was about to leave the Defense Department, put a posting on the Pentagon website that was entitled Rumsfeld, 6 years of accomplishment. Their self-esteem, their arrogance, their blindness knows no bounds. And they've convinced themselves that everything they did was for the right reason and turned out a lot better than people think. I mean, they always go, they're absolutely convinced that the press is maligning them all the time. Rumsfeld would continually talk about Al-Qaeda media committees. He felt that all the bad news about him was coming from Al-Qaeda media committees. I suppose he must think I'm general secretary or something by now. But no, I don't think they do. I don't think they have a moment's doubt. It's actually one of the reasons for all the catastrophes they've brought about is that they're incapable of self-criticism, unfortunately.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us, and for your new book, Andrew Coburn, Rumsfeld: His Rise, Fall, and Catastrophic Legacy. What do you think of Gates? He seems to be trying to assert himself and say, I guess he's saying, I'm not Rumsfeld, right?
Well, yeah, he got the job by not being Donald Rumsfeld. It's very simple.
Right.
Anyone whose name was not Donald Rumsfeld was probably in line for that job. He's a different style, and at least he did get around to firing the man who was in charge of Walter Reed, so that's something. But on the other hand, you've got to remember that the CIA, played a huge, egregiously awful role in the run-up to Iraq by going along with the officially mandated intelligence, and that CIA, all of CIA people who did that, were all the creation of Robert Gates from his time. Mm-hmm. At the CIA. So
you mean the toadies?
What?
The toadies.
Toadies, he was a born toady, and they are his toadies. So,
right.
And
the people who spoke the truth got creamed, so...
Oh, yeah. I mean, they've been starting with back in his day. I mean, he started... Yeah. That was really the real descent into darkness of the CIA when Gates was top dog there, and I don't think it ever recovered. So we all have to bear that in mind, I'm afraid.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Andrew.
Hey.
Bye-bye.
Bye now.
Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. We're just speaking then with Andrew Coburn, who is an author, journalist, has written extensively about the Middle East for the New York Review of Books and also writes for National Geographic and Counterpunch. His new book is Rumsfeld, The Rise, Fall, and Catastrophic Legacy. I thank Lewis Vandenberg, the producer, Rusty Wynn, the associate producer, Carol Coote, the assistant producer, G, the engineer who helped us out, and Tamika Zoghi, the engineer today.